Welcome back to University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm Jack Wilcox in communications here at Extension. Today we're going to discuss soybean nutrient management, highlights of some new research, what to be aware of in 2025, and lots more. Today we have a special guest joining our panel of regulars. We have Lindsay Malone from NDSU. Could you each please introduce yourselves?
So my name is Dr. Lindsay Malone. I am an assistant professor in the School of Natural Resource Sciences. So my position title is Climate Smart Approaches in Agriculture, which encompasses a lot of things. Nutrient management in particular, done a little bit of soybean phosphorus work that I'll talk about a little bit later.
This is Daniel Kaiser. I'm a nutrient management specialist here at the University of Minnesota. One of the areas I work is on soybean, but I work on a lot of crops across the state, looking at fertilizer guidelines for those crops and trying to use fertilizer efficiently and economically.
Hi, this is Dr. Lindsay Pease, and I am a nutrient and water management specialist up in Crookston at the Northwest Research and Outreach Center in Crookston. A lot of my work deals with nutrient management across rotations, but then also how those nutrient management options interact with subsurface drainage.
And I'm Seth Nave. I'm soybean agronomist here based out of St. Paul. We end up, working on some nutrient management related things in my field as well.
Let's begin with an overview of everyone's current research highlights. Did you see any new data or unexpected findings or just a progress report?
Sure. Yeah. So this last year we've had a couple years of trials going on involving soybeans. I think the first one, which is less related to nutrients, but still pretty interesting, has been our planting green trial, where we've been planting soybeans into a living rye cover crop. That's actually been working okay. I would say we've completed about 3 years of that. And what we're seeing is that rye cover does have the potential to kind of limit the soybean yields just a little bit. So the rye cover itself is not looking necessarily like the best way to prevent erosion in these soybean systems. Now, that said, when we've been looking at no-tillage, no-till soybeans, those are incredibly viable. That's working really, really well. So I think this is a good time to kind of push people to think about maybe you can make a small change of not doing skipping fall tillage, preceding soybeans, especially when you have wheat in the rotation. And we are looking at some of the nutrient effects of that as well. But that's kind of going to be a little bit down the line as far as when we have the results on that. Another one that we looked at was kind of looking, especially in the Red River Valley, at corn-soybean rotations and thinking about whether you can do a two-year application of phosphorus versus a one-year application. This pairs really well with that no-till or that reduced tillage system, because if you take out that fall tillage, then you are kind of eliminating your ability to incorporate the phosphorus into the soil, which, as we know, is a really good way of keeping that phosphorus in place. And what we found is that rotational every two-year application of phosphorus does seem to work, and that gave really, consistent yields with our annual every year application in the Red River Valley. So I think these two things kind of work together to show some of the flexibility that you could have with soil fertility when you're starting to transition into maybe a reduced tillage situation.
Fantastic. Thank you, Lindsay. Lindsay Malone in North Dakota, how about yourself?
Absolutely. So similarly, we have some projects that are not directly related to nutrient management. So one in particular that I'm excited about, we're looking at the variability of a cover crop and how that might end up impacting the variability of the main crop yield. We are also looking at some planter technology to help improve no-till in the Red River Valley, especially under really high corn residue situations. One of the factors that's different up here is that we're so cold and wet for so long that the corn residue tends to not break down. A lot of folks fail it or burn it. And so some of this planter technology might help kind of cut through that residue. We're looking at phosphorus, basically updating the phosphorus fertilizer recommendations across the state. And we'll hopefully be able to update the recommendations in the next year or so. And we're planning on actually presenting some results at the Soil and Water Workshop in Fargo on January 22nd in 2025. Briefly, we had 16 different site years for looking at basically we had five different rates of phosphorus on very low P fields. So the idea was that we have a lot of new production areas in North Dakota as well. In 2000, there was about 1 million acres of soybean in North Dakota. And in 2020, there were 6 million. So we've got a lot of areas that don't necessarily, when the fertility recommendations were set, they weren't growing soybean there. However, with those 16 set years, so we only have 8 from 2023, 2 were responsive, and it was just that lowest rate. So 25 pounds per acre was enough to bump up over that zero control. There wasn't necessarily a beautiful curve or anything, and the rest were not responsive to fertilizer. Of the 4 sites that we've looked at so far, so we've looked at Southeast and then kind of West Central Beulah and Dickinson area, those 4 were not responsive this year as well. So we do still have the 2 that were significant in 2023 were in Minot and Mohall, so up quite close to Canada, Central North Dakota. One of the exciting things with this project is that we're also using it to look at AMF populations, so Arbuscular mycorrhizae fungi, and seeing if there is, okay, so maybe these soybeans don't care about how much phosphorus is there. Do they have some microbial friends in the soil helping them get the phosphorus that is available? We are also using Olson pea in North Dakota as that test, and there's a possibility that that Olson pea is not actually telling us enough about the plant available phosphorus. So we're archiving the soil as well, and hopefully another soil fertility specialist is going to look at that in the future. Yeah, that's kind of a North Dakota mini update, or maybe not so many.
In my lab, we've really geared up. We've got a lot of stuff going on. We have projects on planting date around the state. We're really interested in environmental effects of, you know, managing planting date in soybean from north to south, as well as we're experimenting with some double cropping work, looking at effects of following on some of the others that are on the call here today, talking about cover crops versus a sole crop versus even following a wheat or a barley crop. And so we're looking at feasibility of this even in Minnesota. And all of those have modeling components. And I know we're going to try to talk later about how we connect our research and translate our research to the farmer. And modeling has a really interesting angle. I've got a lot of physiology stuff going on soybean quality. We've got a multi-state project on nitrogen fixation that's kind of wrapping up. Like Lindsay, I'm managing a drainage site in southern Minnesota, and we've historically had tillage as a subset of that study, but we're also doing residue removal and cover crops and doing a bunch of other stuff, nitrogen management as well. Looking at soil health measures, but also from a carbon intensity standpoint and trying to evaluate the effect of our production practices on carbon and forms of carbon and available carbon, a wide range of stuff going on. We confirmed what I had kind of wondered about, and I'm really curious from the fertility folks on this panel today, our findings relative to corn stalk removal. Lindsay Malone mentioned this, is that at our drainage site, we see very consistent yield penalties for no-till, and it may be just a couple bushels to maybe 3 or 4 to 5 bushels in some extreme years, and in especially where we don't have drainage. So under poor drainage, no-till suffers. But what's interesting, and this is, you know, we have 7 or 8 years of data from that are pretty consistent. Strip-till, by the way, is completely equivalent to conventional tillage for us, as we've never seen a difference in yields in strip tillage versus conventional till, but no-till gets dinged every year. One way to negate it is actually remove the corn stalks in the previous year. So it's pretty interesting to me is that we can basically negate that no-till penalty if we remove those corn stalks. So it tells me a little bit about something about what's delaying our soybean development and reducing our overall yields is this residue.
So I've got a number of projects going on, but a lot of the stuff I've got right now with soybeans are looking at rotational studies. So it's looking at what we do ahead of the soybeans, how that impacts the soybeans somewhere in the rotation. One of the key things that I've been looking at has been sulfur as of late. And I know there's some interest out there in Minnesota from some of the growers on sulfur applications. The main thing, though, I kind of want to stress with a lot of the work, particularly on sulfur, is it can be location specific. And I think a lot of the stuff that Sean has, there's a few sites he has in Indiana that are pretty responsive to sulfur. And that's one of the things that I'm kind of interested to see now, some of my data. Normally, it takes a few years, and that's one of the things that I found, that it takes a while for it to bleed out some of the previous sulfur applications in some of these systems, where it takes, you know, 1-2 years before you start seeing differences show up between some of the treatments because of some of the, even the sulfate that's in our soil that can carry over from 1 year to the next. So, you know, with soybean, it's not a given that you're going to see a direct application in it. Talk about here in a moment in terms of what some of the growers are doing. I've just got some kind of questions about whether we're pushing too many nutrients on the soybean side where we could get away with everything and on the rotation ahead of corn. But I've wrapped up a lot of the phosphorus work, and that's why it's kind of curious to have Lindsay on here to see her findings on some of that. Soybean hasn't been as responsive. Outside of some of our soils, you get above 5% carbonates, low soil test P, we can see some impacts where some of that carryover becomes some of an issue that we need to be looking at direct applications. But, there's been a lot of flexibility in a lot of what I've seen within a lot of the data we have wherein we fertilize in the rotation. So I think there's some instances out there that there's some things to think about. And we've got some potassium work now looking at timing ahead of soybeans just to get at some more of this chloride issue that I've been seeing with soybean, just to see whether fall versus spring application we see any difference in some of those higher rates and how they impact soybean negatively. That's kind of what we've seen, particularly with high rates of potash over maybe 100 pounds of actual potash. And the final thing, which I think, Lindsay, you're going to be presenting for me up at Grand Forks, we're doing some work with starter fertilizer in soybean. Every once in a while, I'll get a question on that. I kind of cringe when I hear growers talk about that, about putting in furrow directly on soybeans. I mean, if it's not soy green, typically there's some issues, but we're looking specifically at Precision Planting's furrow jet systems. So they've got a couple different placement options on those furrow jets. One is directly on the seed. Then they've got a dual sideband where it's got little wings off the unit that will deflect to an off-seed placement. Looking at the data, at least the first year, we're seeing some pretty significant differences between the on-seed versus the dual sideband, which we weren't seeing the stand issues with it. There weren't any positive benefits on yield, and these were kind of medium to high testing soils, which I kind of expected. But last year, seeing, especially the on-seed placement, you just do not want to get liquid starters near the seed. If it isn't soy green's fine, or soy green-like products are fine, but any NPK fertilizers, things can go bad pretty quickly. I didn't necessarily see the yield loss, but there was no gain, and I lost stands, so I don't really know the point with it, but we'll try to repeat that again because I've just been trying to get some data to show growers. I've had some that have talked about having some pretty bad experience, particularly up in the valley, even with some of these low salt mixes that, it kind of scares you straight when it comes to you thinking about starter fertilizer for soybean.
This is going to be our last episode of 2024. Walk us into 2025. What should farmers be aware of, or what are some concerns going into the new year?
Well, the big thing I've really got concerns in my head are looking at some of these fertilizer prices. Now, you look at potash and nitrogen, those numbers have come down. Obviously, nitrogen isn't a major, thing for soybean. Potash can be, a lot of growers are concerned about it. But, phosphate has been the one that, if you look at the prices, they've been fluctuating, but they've still been high relative to the crop value. And that's one of the things that I'd be interested to talk to growers and consultants this winter, to see what their general attitudes are on for phosphorus. Certainly for, the Lindsay's, both their areas, you get to the west and the northwest, probably more concerns in those areas with high pH and low soil test phosphorus. But, Lindsay Malone, that's what I was wondering about, kind of what you're finding there in North Dakota, because if you look at our data, pretty in tune with some of Iowa's data, and if you look at their response to phosphorus for corn and soybean, they don't see a whole lot of difference if you look at soil test values. But for some reason, you get into Minnesota, these northern climates, and even up in North Dakota, if you look at the soil tests, if we get much above, the Olson test, it would be, 8, 9, somewhere in there. We don't see much of a response. And, Lindsay, is that kind of what you've been finding there as well?
All of our sites, the goal was to have the sites be below 7 ppm. A few of them ended up being a little bit higher than that. But even on some of these sites that had 2 to 5 ppm Olson, we didn't see a response.
I sometimes wonder if that's somewhat IDC. And I don't know, Lindsay, did you have some comment on that?
Kareem Ketterings is who I did at Cornell, is who I did undergraduate research with. And she always says, you can't fertilize yourself out of drought. There's always going to be something that's limiting, and it's not always what you intended. So that is a possibility why we didn't see responses everywhere. I know we had IDC at one of our sites in Richland County this past summer, and we were quite dry at a couple of other sites.
I just wanted to jump in and say, too, that even though some of our trials that we've been doing are not phosphorus rate trials, actually, Lindsay Malone, hearing you talk about your fertilizer response, it actually really fits with what we have been just observing. You know, even outside of a phosphorus rate trial, sometimes it's really hard to get a phosphorus response out of the soybeans. So I think that's really interesting that there kind of seem to be a pattern, especially with these Northwest Minnesota and North Dakota Red River Valley soils. Definitely.
Now, I think, you know, Lindsay Malone hit the point, is right, the nail right in the head, is there's always bigger problems that you can't fertilize your way out of. I mean, we wish we could. I mean, if we could, we'd be getting, you know, 100 bushel beans or more in some of these areas. But it's just kind of an issue with what's the most limiting factor in these particular fields. And that's the thing that really frustrates me. You know, and I guess, Seth, you've been doing soybean research for longer than I have, but, you know, just finding some of these things that, you know, growers really want, just these little things that they can boost yields by a small amount, especially fertility-wise, and I just haven't seen them consistently. I mean, really the main thing is just essentially assuring that nutrients aren't going to be non-limiting. And you know, just at a meeting, and, you know, there was some industry reps and some growers there. And one of the things that always comes up is micros, foliar application, you know, looking at trying to chase these small yield increases. And it's difficult, you know, with where prices are at and the cost of a lot of these different practices. I don't see the advantage there, especially if you're foregoing some of the base fertility, especially P and K. I mean, those are the areas that I'd worry about more than anything. And, you know, the chloride issue, I think, is real to be considered about. Is a lot of times growers now, you want to go and look at applying ahead of every crop, and there can be some issues that come into play. And I think we've probably talked about that quite a bit in some other posts that we've been doing, but it's just one of those things. And Seth, I mean, I don't know, is there anything else? I mean, you finished some of that work on the foliar work, and I'm assuming you haven't really done anything since the last few years.
Yeah, that was a multi-state project. We took an agronomist perspective of it and just said, okay, let's assume we're regular farmers trying to maximize yields. Let's buy a bunch of products that's going to get us higher yields and see what works. And basically, we found nothing that worked anywhere, except there's a couple locations that had poor soil test values, and it covered up some of our sins at those locations. But that was it. And we, you know, those are obviously ones that we should have just, you know, used regular fertilizers to correct those particular issues. You guys are hitting on something that's really kind of just clicked with me very recently, is around soybean kind of yield potential and how we manage soybeans. And so we had 25 years of really high quality data that we could separate out by yield potential in those various years. And when we had really good yield potentials, we had a slight decline in yield potential over time. So earlier planting was better. But anytime we had a year that was a little bit dry, we had no yield advantage to planting before the end of May. All of the things that you've been talking about, both you, Dan, and Lindsay have been talking about, is these other factors that cap soybean yields. And then how do we manage soybeans that are capped? Generally, soybean agronomists give blanket recommendations for farmers and just say, okay, this is how you should treat all your soybean acres. And farmers like that anyway, because that's how they're going to manage their soybeans. But the reality is, I think when we're in this situation with low prices, is that it may be reasonable for farmers to really look critically at their acres. And if they have production acres that are, they have their yield monitor data, they know where they're not getting good yields. They're probably not going to fix these low yields with any of these biologicals or foliar fertilizers or name any of these other products that are being sold to them to fix those problems. So maybe they could back off a little bit on those. So we're trying to get a more objective view of that. And I think we haven't thought about it necessarily from a fertility perspective, although we're in some of our field studies, we are using mid-season liquid fertilizers just to ensure that we don't have a problem, is basically a check for us to make sure that we weren't limited by nutrients. But I think this is kind of coming around to this idea that maybe we need to be managing some of these acres differently. And I think IDC is a really good example. Everybody knows what a yellow bean is, and they know that soybean isn't going to yield well. But then there's this whole other category of soybeans that just are chronically limited. And a lot of times it's probably water one way or the other.
Being further south, you may have a little bit more advantage. I mean, that's something I don't know, being up north. I mean, water is a big issue either. The last few years, I mean, both of you, it's probably been too dry. So, you know, I am curious too, a little bit, you know, Lindsay Malone, with some of your work on the mycorrhiza too, and in terms of seeing what comes out of that, how much colonization we see, because, you know, given when we generally plant soybean, I mean, I would assume, you know, potentially some of these phosphorus or the lack of issues might be just from the fact that they're later planted and it's a little easier to colonize.
Dan, I can speak a little bit to those AMF results. Initially, why we started looking at this was because we're looking for really low phosphorus level fields in order to run these rate trials. Got set up in this field with generally the whole field is quite low, below 5 ppm Olsen. But we set up relatively close to the road where 50 years ago there was a farmstead and a barnyard, and it actually had really high phosphorus. And so we ended up setting up a second little rate trial, but we maintained the initial one that we set up. So we had a one that was kind of over 20 ppm, and then one that was closer to that 5 ppm level. And I was really curious about how those native AMF populations would respond or kind of exist across that area. We actually saw higher colonization in the high phosphorus area, which really surprised my agronomist brain. But we're working with a biologist here at NDSU, and she's like, in native systems, that actually makes a lot of sense because these symbionts, they want to grow somewhere that has high nutrient availability. Yeah, so we just looked at the one site in 2023. In 2024, we looked at 4 of our 8 sites and didn't see any major responses to that fertilizer addition, and we haven't seen a strong connection with the spring tea either. We did have higher colonization at one site that is our true no-till site, and that was in Dickinson, I believe. It might have been Beulah, but tillage does it basically rips up those hyphae in the soil and can really have a detrimental effect on AMF populations. So that's kind of our major theory.
Seth, is there anything new about IDC that might be of concern to growers?
My feeling on IDC for this year is there isn't anything really new for us to deal with. I think the challenge is that under really good economic scenarios, farmers were able to utilize soy green in a little bit or other iron chelates in a little bit more liberal fashion. So they were either able to use higher rates in their hotspots or push the boundaries of those areas of where they were going to treat, or maybe even treat whole fields where they hadn't before. So I think there's going to be some pulling back of this total amount of product that goes out, simply because when I talk to farmers, the IDC that they have is not regular. They don't always have IDC. Now, certain areas of certain fields are always going to get a little bit, and they can treat those. But whether they treat, 10 acres in one field or one field or 10 fields really depends on their perspective of how much loss they've had and looking at the economics. So I think there's going to be less go out, and that's really going to hurt us in terms of our yield potentials, I think, because if we do have a bad IDC year, then we just won't have some of that iron available for those areas.
I've got some of the same thoughts too, Seth. I mean, you look at the iron chelates, they've traditionally been expensive. I mean, that was one of the reasons we didn't have products like soy green on the market, because at the point in time it was tested, 30, 40 years ago, it just was too expensive to make the stuff where it was economically viable. So, I mean, really growers, I think you look at what some of the companies have done with varieties, variety selection has always been my number one line of defense. And then these other things are kind of, just looking at trying to boost the yield here and there. And kind of curious on the mycorrhizal side too, because there was, somebody pointed out where they were thinking that maybe the mycorrhizal, since they do impact water uptake, I mean, theoretically they could impact the uptake of nitrate, which is, one of our issues with IDC, that, maybe the previous crop might have some impacts. I know that was one of the consultants I've known for quite a while. His thinking was, following a crop like sugar beets, that soybean may not have IDC as bad as it would from a crop like corn, which has mycorrhizal. Now, sugar beets really good at extracting nitrate. So, you're looking at differences in nitrate potentially between similar rates of nitrogen applied between a corn versus sugar beet. But with the rain we had early on in many of these areas, what happens next year? Because I haven't really heard yet any reports on the residual nitrates coming into 2025, and then I guess it'll be telling what we see in the spring with the weather conditions and if the residual nitrates are down, if things are any better in 2025 versus some of the previous years.
We've had so many droughty falls. We've been talking about nitrate carry over quite a bit, and so I guess that is really a good point and where we're at with that. Lindsay Pease did bring up the question earlier about drainage effects, and I think that's a good question, what we're going to see going forward. And I'm really curious, too, is to know the long-term effects of artificial drainage in valley soils on IDC. And, we don't have good controls for this to look at how this behaves over a long period of time in farmer fields, but it'd be interesting to hear from farmers and really find out how they think that this is really affected. I know psychologically farmers are going to tell me, yes, this has really helped me a lot because I spent a whole bunch of money on this. And so I believe that it's helped me, but we also need to have a realistic view of it as well.
I mean, as dry as it's been, you know, we do know there's probably some upward movement or wicking of water up carrying solutes back towards the surface. I've kind of wondered if that maybe is what influenced some, you know, growers saying, well, there's some areas we haven't seen IDC in years. And in 2024, you know, we saw it pretty severely. So, you know, it's one of the things with water and drainage. I mean, things can happen. I mean, I'm not necessarily convinced that we can completely get rid of issues with drainage. I think there's some issues there that just aren't going to go away. The thing that I will say is do not buy into any of this elemental sulfur talk where you can acidify your soil, because if you look at it, you're treating the top 6 inches and there's a lot more, especially carbonate below that top 6 inches, that's just going to replace what you're going to get rid of with the elemental sulfur. So it's, I think the thing about IDC, it's here to stay. So it's just, you know, seeing how best we can deal with it is really the main thing with some of the options that we have.
You know, going back to drainage, you know, as a way, you know, to, I mean, drainage is going to help move soluble salts down the soil profile. And then that includes the nitrates, you know, which of course is not the best for water quality, but actually can really be something that helps with the IDC. In addition to any other soluble salts you have out there, you know, the like chloride salts. So one thing that I think is important to think about with IDC is if you have installed the subsurface drainage system and you don't see those salt symptoms improving, that's actually a signal that you have some non-soluble salts out there. And that's what those products like Soygreen are really targeting. They're trying to exchange those salts from a chemistry perspective. They're doing a swap, a one-to-one swap of something that is soluble with something that is non-soluble to make those salts available to be leached. So I think that's something, you know, to be mindful of, especially with all of this drainage going in the valley. If you're like, man, you know, I put this drainage out. Of course, we have had the droughts, like Dan says, and the droughts make salts wick back up. But, you know, we had 2024, early 2024 was a great time for those salts to be washed back down. And we definitely saw that, you know, on my drainage site, things kind of washing back down. So if you're having those consistent issues, then you need to apply something to replace, to do a swap so that it can be leached. It's, I guess, basically my big take home message.
Well, and I think some of the salt issues in those areas too. I know Dave Franzen always talked about sulfates being a major contributor to the salt. So magnesium, calcium, sulfate, those type of things. So as I said, it's complicated. I mean, it's not simple. You think you can fix it with one thing, but these systems in the soil, it's not a easy thing to fix.
Yeah, I know I said at the top of the call that I'm still relatively new here. While yes, I feel like the drought of the end of the season is top of mind. We were so wet in May. I think we had planting dates in late April and then planting dates in June this year. That moisture issue on both ends, at least especially in the red, kind of heart of the Red River Valley where we've got these Fargo clays, is tough. And managing that moisture on both ends, whether that's through artificial drainage. I know there's a lot of folks trying to use cover crops to help improve trafficability early in the season. I think we're at kind of an interesting point. I'm excited to see in 2025 and even in 2026, some of these management practices becoming more common and being able to see, yes, like Seth said, we don't have necessarily a controlled comparison next to each other, but we've got fields across the street that could be really interesting to look at.
And theoretically, the cover crops, if it is a nitrate issue with IDC, I mean, if you got something out there that's growing that's taking up the nitrate, you know, could have some benefits. I don't know if anybody's really looked at that closely, but it's a topic for another time.
Seth Nave, Lindsay Malone, Dan Kaiser, and Lindsay Pease, thank you so much for your expertise today.
Thank you.
It's great to be here on this podcast with everybody today.
Thanks for having me on. It's been great.
Before we go, if you have a question or comment for one of our guests or a topic you'd like discussed in an upcoming episode, please email us at nutmgmt@umn.edu. Thanks, and we look forward to hearing from you. That about does it for this episode of the Nutrient Management Podcast. We'd like to thank the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, or AFREC, for supporting the podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2025.